Good shoes. What's the matter, Morty?
Great gowns, beautiful gowns.
Fashion has changed.
No, it hasn't.
Hi, I'm Lauren Garoni.
And I'm Chelsea Fairless. Welcome to yet another episode of the Every Outfit podcast.
We cannot be stopped, Chelsea.
We're still doing this. Why? I don't know.
Because the people want it. And by the people, I mean the tens upon tens of people that listen to this podcast every week.
I just want to say I've had a bit of anxiety about recording this week because I feel like I'm off my game because my dear friend Jesus Guerrero passed away this week very unexpectedly. He was only 34. He was a really beautiful person. He was very, very close with my wife. They were like two peas in an oversized black Balenciaga pod. And it's horrible. It's just horrible. And it's sad. And some of you may have read about this online because Jesus was a celebrity hairstylist. He worked with Kylie and Kim and Katie and J-Lo and everyone, and he was so talented, but I feel like his career was actually the least interesting thing about him. He was such a kind-hearted, generous person, and I had grand plans to write him a really fabulous obituary for the pod, which really encapsulated who he was, but I just do not want to cry on the podcast today, and I don't think that Jesus would want me to be a messy bitch, so to speak. So I guess I just want people to know that he was a really beautiful person, and he was the best, and we're going to miss him so much.
Okay, guys, I'm going over to hug Chelsea, just so you know.
Oh, I guess I appreciate when I hear from people that listen to this podcast when they say I'm going through something hard, and I like listening to the show because it distracts me from all of those things. It's a privilege to be able to do that, and I think today I need a little bit of that myself, which is why I'm going to instigate a hard pivot into pop culture. But Lauren, first, we have an exciting little announcement. Again, horrible transition. I don't know how we get out of that, but we will.
This is maybe the hardest transition we've ever done, but we are going to get into all of the pop culture things that we've missed the past few weeks. But I just want to tell the fuckettes to stay tuned, because later in this episode, we are going to be talking to Liz Goldwyn.
The legend.
Yes, we're breaking podcast protocol for a very special person, which is Liz Goldwyn. Cannot wait for that discussion, which at this time hasn't happened yet, but will.
It will, and hopefully I will have collected myself by then. Anywho, the SAG Awards. That happened. I watched it. I remember very little, but perhaps you can refresh my memory.
Well, I'll start by saying I was there with you. I came over on Sunday and we watched the red carpet together. This year, the SAG Awards were hosted on Netflix, which I wonder if that's led people to watch it more.
Yes, Netflix was a glow up for the SAG Awards, one that it desperately needed.
I do know that Netflix is putting on more live events, but I just have to say that when I saw the phrase "a Netflix live event" come across as the SAG Awards were starting, something felt incorrect about that. Netflix, I need you to show me a movie that came out 7 years ago that I've never heard of. That's your place in my life.
No, I think this is good, because the SAG Awards is something that we've always watched because we're huge fucking nerds. So we care. And it's kind of validating that it has a better distributor, that there are potentially more eyeballs on the SAG Awards.
That there might be an overlap between those that watch the Jake Paul Mike Tyson fight might also be watching Jane Fonda give a rousing Lifetime Achievement Award speech.
Do we want to start with the fashion or the awards?
I say let's get into the what I'll call notable looks. I have three.
Okay.
Cynthia Erivo in Givenchy Haute Couture, Fall Winter 1997.
Designed by McQueen. Styled by Jason Bolden, who also styles Nicole Kidman and has been crushing it lately. This was so special, and you can really see the thought process here, because this gown was originally modeled by Deborah Shaw on the runway, who of all models has the closest physical resemblance to Cynthia Erivo. So it's quite cool to see this piece reemerge on someone that is close to who McQueen envisioned wearing this to begin with.
I know that we've spoken, or shall I say, I've spoken about my tiredness of celebrities and stylists pulling archival looks for the runway, but I want it to be understood, I don't mean this look.
When it's done right, it's done right. I'm with you. Okay, who else?
Pamela Anderson in Dior, wearing no makeup, but a full 1950s glamour hair beat, which is, I think, what we need to discuss.
Yeah, I think you either have to add makeup or take away hair, which is what I would have done.
Yeah, and I think that kind of Grecian style dress that she was wearing would have looked better with...
Not that hair.
Not that hair. Like, if there was just stick straight Pamela Anderson, no makeup, kind of an Ally McGraw in the 70s vibe, stronger look.
A lot of stars could do less contrived beauty and hair in general, but she was beautiful and the gown was beautiful.
Well, I think the perfect intersection of a contrived look that also feels effortless would be Timmy in his leather chrome heart suit.
He looked cool as fuck. And I say that as someone that hates a bolo tie 99% of the time. This was that 1% of bolo ties that I actually like.
His style and also the stunts he's been pulling on the Complete Unknown press tour. Like, he showed up to London on a Lime bike. I think at the New York premiere, he dressed like Bob Dylan. But the way Bob Dylan looked at the Sundance premiere of a movie he was in 2003.
It's really great because we've seen him do twinky Eddie Slimane red carpet thing where he looks very chic and very tasteful. And I think it's interesting to see him experimenting with different silhouettes and being a bit more eccentric. And I'm not the biggest chrome hearts person, as we previously established, but this is what they do best. This and make leather jackets with crosses for Cher.
If Timmy is any previous actor reincarnate, it is less Daniel Day-Lewis or Leonardo DiCaprio. It is Nicolas Cage. And there is no man who would show up on the red carpet in a full chrome hearts leather suit more than Nicolas Cage. And now, Timmy.
I also liked seeing Coleman Domingo and Drew Starkey in Valentino. There is nothing chicer than a man who can pull off a scarf that doesn't look like he's trying too hard. You know, that's something that can really go either way. And when it works, it really works. And I think it works here. They look very classic, but it's also just more interesting than a typical tuxedo. Although, you know who wore a typical tuxedo and looked fucking major? Ted Danson.
Guys, well, I see you remember, because all I remember from your red carpet commentary and your commentary for the SAG is how much you love Ted Danson.
There is no amount of fashion that can create the raw elegance that Ted Danson just naturally possesses. He, to me, is the most beautiful guy. It's actually kind of astounding how elegant he is.
I think the shock of white hair does a lot as well.
The bone structure, the height, just the way he carries himself and the way he moves. I'm surprised that he hasn't been brought into this sort of Prada, man of a certain age, brand ambassador fold.
He's got to stop doing network television. That's his crime.
That's what's holding him back. But to me, of all of the actors, especially television actors, he's really aged like a fine wine. This is glamour.
I also just want to tell the fuckettes that a highlight for me was I got to explain to you that Drew Starkey and Harris Dickinson are two separate men, even though, to be fair, they look exactly the same.
And I still don't know which one is which.
Which one's in Queer and which one is in Baby Girl? I'll tell you one thing, Chell. It's not the one you think.
Also, another person that I really liked at the SAG Awards was Nicola Coughlan. Apologies to the Irish people if I'm butchering her name. In Dior. I don't think that Dior is doing a lot of interesting things these days, as we've previously established, but one thing that they are doing is recreating highly recognizable Dior designs from the 40s and 50s on plus-sized women. We first saw this with Izoud at Cannes when they recreated the bar suit for her. And now we get this very classic belted coat dress. And it's cool to see women who were not historically able to wear these clothes wear these clothes. And I also think it just speaks to the general timelessness of Christian Dior and how brilliant his designs are. And they're brilliant on people that he never even envisioned wearing his clothes. And this led me to wonder, like, what is Dior's sizing actually like? Because can you buy this shit? And I was pleased to discover, I don't know if this is true of all of their clothes, I doubt that it is, but if you want to get that very classic Dior bar jacket, they go up to a size 50, which is basically a 2XL.
What helped make this look not be 1950s glamour drag is the inclusion of the opera length black leather gloves.
I think the biggest trapping of the old Hollywood look is when you start to look like Jessica Rabbit, and not in a cool Amanda Lepore kind of way.
There's only one person who can make it cool, and that's Amanda Lepore.
Truly. Oh, also, Jamie Lee Curtis in Dolce, it was very like Drag Race meets Fellini. But I don't mean that as a diss. I mean that as a compliment. I love how extreme and campy and bizarre it was. And she certainly has the personality to go along with a really showy, kind of funny look like that.
Yeah, I feel like she's also become what Jack Nicholson was in the 90s to award shows. She's kind of become that person. Like, certainly when she announced that Colin Farrell won, she announced it by revealing that he gave her COVID at the Golden Globes, which is sort of that in Hollywood goss that I enjoy, that I feel like is missing in the over-publicized, over-policing that goes on in Hollywood right now. So, love her.
Moving on to the ceremony, where do we want to start?
At the tippy top, I did appreciate, even though Kristen Bell hosted, she was not in the opening segment, which was basically a scene from Hacks, written for the SAG Awards, with the idea being that Deborah Vance has been asked to host the SAG Awards, which, I mean, a bold choice, because for the first few minutes I was like, that actually would be great if Jean Smart as Deborah Vance hosted the SAG Awards.
That needs to happen. Don't tease a better concept.
But she wasn't the host, of course. Meg Statler got it wrong. She's not hosting the SAG Awards. It was instead Kristen Bell, who, yeah, I guess she has the correct personality to be an award show host.
That doesn't exactly sound like a rave.
No, I think she has the perfect bouncy personality. She's coming off of a very successful Netflix television series, which you did not care for. Nobody wants this.
Yeah, not me. Did not want.
Yeah, you took the title to heart, but she can sing, she can dance. This probably went over both of our heads, but I subsequently read that the singing piece that she did at the beginning, Do You Want to Be an Actor, was reworking lyrics from the song Do You Want to Build a Snowman from Frozen.
See, I didn't know that either.
Yeah. See, the SAG Awards never miss, just because since the beginning of the award show, they've had a winning bit. And that bit is the I'm an actor bit, which is what is typically kicked off the show, where they go in the audience and different actors say their first moments of them knowing when they wanted to be an actor or embarrassing first roles they had.
It's very public service announcement.
I know that the SAG Awards are kind of cringe because it's actors awarding other actors, talking about how important acting is. But on the other side of things, it is maybe the only outward-facing pro-union event.
Yeah.
Because they're in the Screen Actors Guild, and basically everyone that gets on stage talks about how great being in a union is.
Being in a union is great. I thought it was so cool that when Timmy won, he thanked his mom, who works for Actors Equity, which is basically SAG for theater actors. So a lot of people in SAG are also in Actors Equity. Yes, we love unions, especially here on the Every Outfit podcast.
Except the fact that there's no podcasting union.
Speaking of Timmy's speech.
And lastly, I can't downplay the significance of this award because it means the most to me. And I know we're in a subjective business, but the truth is I'm really in pursuit of greatness. I know people don't usually talk like that, but I want to be one of the greats. I'm inspired by the greats. I'm inspired by the greats here tonight.
I felt a pretty uncontroversial statement, but I don't know. According to the internet, people had issues with this, but I don't know if that's actually true, because I just immediately saw the backlash to people thinking that this speech was annoying.
I don't think it's annoying. He's being honest. And he said people expect you to sort of downplay and pretend like all of this was effortless. But he said this was 5 years of my life playing this character, preparing for this role. I don't fault him for that. As someone that has no desire to pursue greatness themselves, I appreciate other people who are like that, who are perfectionists, who want to master their craft.
It does bear a conversation of, like, last year you had someone like Bradley Cooper who made Maestro. He wrote it, he directed it, he was in it. He spent years with Leonard Bernstein's family. And somehow he was looked at as a tryhard. But for Timmy to just outwardly be like, yeah, I want to be one of the greats, why is that different? Timmy's just got Riz.
He does, and he deserved this award, and I'm happy he won.
I agree with you. His performances and all of the other performances did elevate what could have otherwise been a pretty trite biopic.
Well, I think it was just exciting to see someone else win, because the same people have been winning all throughout awards season thus far. This was an upset.
And he did say backstage that this was the only time in the award season run that he actually didn't write a speech. He was like, I have written a speech for every other award show and I've lost. So today I was like, fuck it. And I won.
Well, I'm sure this was a version of one of those speeches.
Look, I appreciate that he was basically the only actor who did not comment about how heavy the award was.
Yeah, that was a breath of fresh.
As soon as Kieran Culkin, who was the first to win, discussed for the bulk of his speech, which was brilliant when he did it, about the weight of the award and the self-importance of actors, and that's probably why they made this award so heavy. That was brilliant, but I knew every other person who got on stage was going to be like, wow, Kieran was right, it is heavy.
Having held one of those, they are incredibly heavy. It's actually crazy that that's what they give people. But you know what's even crazier? The award that the lifetime achievement person gets at SAG, that's kind of like a tragedy comedy mask. It's the scariest looking award I've ever seen. Do you know what I'm talking about?
No, of course I know what you're talking about. I mean, it makes sense that that would be the lifetime achievement award, but also because it's the lifetime achievement award, I hope it's not as heavy as the regular SAG awards. What are you trying to kill, Jane Fonda?
That was cool. Jane Fonda is one of the most profoundly inspiring people on the planet. She could have just been a really good actress. You know, she didn't need to do all that, but she did.
Yeah, and she's one of the few actors who has really walked the walk and talked the talk, and she talked that talk in this speech as well.
Make no mistake, empathy is not weak or woke. And by the way, woke just means you give a damn about other people.
As someone whose parents habitually watch Bill Maher's Club Random.
Same. We need to start a support group.
I'm sure your parents let you know that Jane Fonda was recently on Club Random and spent the entire time just like confused about what was going on and what Bill Maher was saying. I feel like her redefining woke was directly to Bill Maher and her experience of being on Club Random.
Yeah, she's such a real one. Like, this woman didn't have to spend her 80s protesting climate change and police violence.
And getting arrested.
But she does. She's always showed up for the people. She's just such an incredible woman. And when you watch the clips of, like, all of those movies, because they, of course, show the montage of her career, you just forget the scope of her body of work and how brilliant she is and how progressive a lot of the films that she started were also. Like, when I was watching the clips of They Shoot Horses, Don't They? I was like, at what point in this dystopian economy do we just start doing those dance marathons again?
Oh, you mean in 2025?
Yeah.
We're definitely going to be doing that in time for the 2028 Los Angeles Olympics. It'll be an Olympic sport by then. Well, her speech was also a call to action as well.
Have any of you ever watched a documentary of one of the great social movements, like apartheid or our civil rights movement or Stonewall, and asked yourself, would you have been brave enough to walk the bridge? Would you have been able to take the hoses and the batons and the dogs? We don't have to wonder anymore because we are in our documentary moment. This is it.
When she was saying that of like, would you be brave enough? In my head, I was like, no. And then she was like, this moment is now. And I was like, oh shit, okay, I gotta get brave enough. Jade is telling me.
Yeah, and it makes sense that she would use this event to wake up the people in that room, because this is a room full of famous people that have an enormous influence, people that have just as much influence as she does, that all have platforms. And of course, as the activist that she is, she's such a good communicator. Of course, she wants to implore people to resist. That is her legacy.
Yeah, her legacy can't be influencing Chelsea Handler to be a philanthropist and an activist. We need other people. Elle Fanning, we need you to resist.
We love her. We love Jane. Although, I think Armani did her dirty with that gown. The little squiggle lace appliques reminded me of leeches. It reminded me of that one part in Little House on a Prairie that's like so traumatic. Did you never read those books?
Is it messed up that I was like, what episode of Little House on the Prairie was that? What happened with the leeches, Chell? And how did the Armani Privé remind you of this?
Well, have you seen a leech?
Yeah.
Well, it looked like Jane Fonda's gown. That's what I'm saying. It's a squiggly, fat, little black thing that lays on your skin and sucks out all your blood.
How dare you? The artisans at Armani spent hundreds of hours sewing those leeches in.
I think they could have done less. That's all I'm saying. No shade to Jane, but was a little distracted by the dress.
Okay, before we move on, I need to get your opinion on, I think, the other greatest bit of the SAG Awards, which was the Law and Order clip package, which frankly, they could make a yearly tradition.
They should.
I think they really, and sorry for this gross phrase, but like blew their load, because you could do this bit every year and figure out who of the people who have been nominated that year have been in Law and Order.
Everyone's been on Law and Order. Some people have been on Law and Order multiple times.
Yeah.
Like Hayden Panettiere.
Was it Tony Hale who didn't remember that he had been on twice? What a life that you could be on Law & Order as a guest star so many times you've forgotten.
Friend of the pod, Emma Miles, she was on three times. She played a woman that pretended to have a baby so she could shoplift cough syrup to make meth.
Ooh.
She played some sort of white supremacist woman. And then she played a woman that got gang raped by a biker gang. And that was over the span of a decade.
If I were ever on Law and Order, which I won't, I would want to be the first person that the detectives interact with, that tell them to go to the person that tells them to go to the person that actually did the crime. I want to be that person who's third removed from the crime.
Sometimes that person actually ends up being the criminal, though.
Ooh.
Just saying.
I'm not talented enough for that. So we have missed a few weeks of award shows. This is our Olympics, frankly, and it's, as of Sunday, going to come to an end. So where do we stand going into the Oscars? Zoe Saldana and Kieran Culkin have swept all the major awards in their respective categories. Pretty likely they are going to win Best Supporting Actress and Best Supporting Actor. You've just let out a very heavy sigh.
Well, it's just predictable. Like, of course they deserve it. But I would really like to see the Anora guy just randomly win an Oscar.
I think he won the Indie Spirit Award. That's where Mikey Madison won Best Actress as well.
Yeah, I'm sick of this Anora erasure.
Well, it's interesting that you say that, because Demi Moore has won every award in her category, although Mikey Madison did take the Best Actress award at the Independent Spirit Awards. So could there be an Oscar upset?
Like a Glenn Close situation?
I was just going to say, Glenn Close won the Golden Globe, SAG, and Spirit Award, but lost the Oscar to Olivia Colman. I mean, if this happens to Demi Moore, I think she has to have a substance-esque breakdown in the mirror in the bathroom at the Dolby Theater.
I was about to say she should vomit blood all over the entire audience.
Ooh, that's better. But Anora did sweep the PGA, WGA, and DGA awards, which is usually an indicator of what will win Best Picture. Because the only movie to win all of those awards but lose Best Picture at the Oscar was Brokeback Mountain, which lost to the movie Crash, Chelsea. Do with that what you will for your Oscar pool this weekend. So Timmy did win at the SAG.
Timmy did win at the SAG? What are you, 80 years old?
All right, you're having a hard week, so I'll let you bully me. Timothy Chalamet won Best Actor at the SAG Awards over the frontrunner Adrian Brody. Does that mean we will have an Oscar upset? I know how you're going to vote with your Oscar ballot this weekend.
Yeah, but I did love Adrian Brody so much.
And he did do the most acting in The Brutalist.
I think Brutalist should win Best Picture personally.
Right.
But maybe Conclave. Not to be like a conspiracy theorist, but don't you think it's a little shocking that the Pope is having this health crisis at the peak of the Conclave awards circuit? Like, is this the best or the worst PR? I can't figure it out.
I think the marketing department at Fox Searchlight deserves a raise. I also want to bring up, there are award shows that are a bit more of a meritocracy, but the Oscars often make no sense, and you really understand that this week, because this is when The Hollywood Reporter and Variety start posting those anonymous Oscar ballots, where people who are in the Academy and have voted anonymously explain how they voted and why. And Variety, in their feature, noted that two separate Oscar voters said that they did not vote for Ralph Fiennes for his performance in Conclave because he had already won an Oscar for his performance in Schindler's List. Fair enough. Except he didn't win an Oscar for Schindler's List.
Who won that Oscar?
He lost Best Supporting Actor to Tommy Lee Jones in The Fugitive.
Okay, fair enough.
But I love that they're like, look, we voted for Adrian Brody because Ralph Fiennes has already won an Oscar. And it's like, no, he hasn't, but Adrian Brody has. And Chelsea, if there is an upset and Timmy did win, he would be the youngest actor to win Best Actor Oscar, usurping Adrian Brody, who has been the youngest Best Actor winner.
Wow. Well, I'm rooting for Timmy. Although so many great performances, they're all very deserving.
Well, Chelsea, are you rooting for Carla Sofia Gascon? Because Variety reported that she will be attending the Oscars and Netflix will be paying for her expenses to travel there.
Fair enough. She's nominated. How many problematic people have been nominated for Oscars?
I mean, look at Harvey Weinstein. The last time he was at the Academy Awards, he was sat next to Anna Wintour.
So let her have her moment.
And then, Chelsea, since we last recorded, I'm very excited to tell you, it has been widely reported that the Oscars will open with a Wicked medley performed by Cynthia Erivo and Ariana Grande.
Beautiful.
That I'm sure the host Conan O'Brien will crash into and end abruptly.
Oh God, is he going to be the Ethan Slater character?
Oh, maybe.
Or is he going to be the bear midwife or the goat professor?
I erased from my memory the bear midwife. God damn it, Chelsea. Also, it's been reported this week that for some reason, Doja Cat, Lisa of Blackpink, and Ray will all be performing a song at the Academy Awards together.
Is that like in memoriam, though? Because that could be a weird vibe.
Yeah, because they're not having singers sing the best original song. So yeah, I guess they're only other song opportunities in memoriam. Ooh.
I love that someone made the executive decision that the songs this year are all flops and we simply can't devote this much time to them. But what we actually need them to bring back is the fashion show of the costume design nominees.
If you want to do a produced piece, you want to get a younger generation to watch, have Kendall Jenner and Bella Hadid model the costumes.
Imagine, like, the Conclave section. It will literally be like that Fellini movie.
There's always next year. Another thing that came out while we were discussing other things was the fact that Brutalist writer-director Brady Corbet has made $0 from his film.
This is obviously a blatant lie, because he made money from directing the film, but then he also had to do all of this promotional stuff that he wasn't paid for, so he spent the money that he made from directing the film and now has $0, which is just what having a job is for most people. Seriously.
Sorry, Brady. Get used to it.
It's not that he wasn't paid. It's that he has no money left over.
Okay. He was on the Marc Maron podcast and he was explaining that he had just gotten his first real paycheck in many years from directing 3 ads in Portugal. Brady Corbet said, both my partner and I made $0 on the last 2 movies we made. Yes, actually zero. So we had to just live off a paycheck from 3 years ago. And obviously the timing during an awards campaign and travel every 2 or 3 days was less than ideal. But it was an opportunity that landed in my lap and I jumped at it. Was he paid for The Brutalist? I'm sure he was. Did he potentially forfeit his director's fee to put it back in the budget so that he could afford some amazing Brutalist architecture or production design?
That sounds just like the plot of The Brutalist.
I related deeply to this because I too made an independent feature last year. Not as lauded as The Brutalist, shockingly enough, but I will be transparent. Do you know how much money I made while making my directorial debut?
How much?
$0, because I gave my fee, my co-writer Brie Esrig, we gave our fees back to the production budget so that we could pay other people a better rate and also, like, get the clothing we wanted in the movie.
So you spent the money, is what you're saying.
The money was spent elsewhere, yes. Yes, I think when he says he made $0, he either forfeited his paycheck or perhaps, yes, made the film years ago and has not worked since because he's been dedicated to, right, when you make a movie, it is not just production, it is post-production. And as he says, because the film premiered, I believe at Cannes or Venice, he has been promoting the movie for nearly a year and you do not get paid for that.
They're flying him business class, though.
I was going to add that asterisk of like, yeah, you're not getting paid day by day, but you are, per your guild, getting paid business class.
A per diem.
You're getting a per diem. Your hotel stay in a fabulous European country is being paid for, your transportation. So you're not getting a salary to promote your film, but you're also not having to pay to do this either.
Look, I think it's good that he's talking about this because I think the public has all kinds of misconceptions about how much people in the entertainment industry make. And of course, there is a huge spectrum. Most directors aren't raking in Michael Bay money.
Yeah, some of us have to subsidize our hobby of writing and directing with the shockingly lucrative career of podcasting. That was Brady Corbet's problem. He's too dedicated making brilliant movies. He's not hosting a podcast.
He needs to get on the mic.
You know who is making money, Chell? Our fave Lena Dunham. Guys, I'm always sending Chelsea stories in our chat together, and I never know what will resonate. So I was thrilled that when I sent you that Lena Dunham is working on a new movie with Natalie Portman, that this really resonated with you. So she's written a rom-com.
It's called Good Sex.
This is the synopsis. After spending a decade in a failed relationship, successful couples therapist Allie, played by Natalie Portman, or will be played by Natalie Portman, is turning 40 and is pushed kicking and screaming by her best friend back into the hopeless New York dating scene. But Allie finds her life pulled in opposing directions as she falls into a steamy fling with a 20-something-year-old Brooklyn hipster. Are we still using the phrase hipster? Sorry. Just as she begins a promising, more conventional relationship with Alan, a successful 50-something in Manhattan. As a romantic crossroads blossoms into a full-blown identity crisis, Allie juggles to keep these two very different men separate and to make sense of her own conflicting desires before she risks losing them both. Love it. Great.
Can't wait to watch this. Also, we need Natalie Portman in a better rom-com than No Strings Attached.
Absolutely.
We as millennials deserve our own millennial Nora Ephron, and I think that is a great lane for Lena Dunham to be in. There were always rom-com elements of girls, and she was always good at sort of subverting some of those rom-com tropes on that show. So it makes sense that she would evolve into the sort of person that would be writing these kinds of movies. No one's writing good ones.
No, I agree with you. And you know who else agrees? Hollywood, Chelsea, because this is an independent feature, quite like Brady Corbet's The Brutalist. They've attached Natalie Portman and they brought it to buyers at the European film market. And this package has sparked a bidding war between Warner Brothers, Amazon, Apple, and Netflix, who all want to make this movie. And the offers could be $45 million to be able to have the privilege to make and distribute a Lena Dunham rom-com.
That's so insane.
As of the time of recording, there's been no other update, but as we're becoming women of a certain age ourselves, I'm glad that the rom-com genre is being reawakened.
Same. Of all the genres, it is the most lacking in quality. Like, the fact that we have incredibly highbrow, smart, contemporary horror movies now, and people still don't know how to make a romantic comedy is crazy to me.
However, I do feel like after this movie, no more movies where a 40-year-old woman has sex with a younger guy. We have enough. We have the Anne Hathaway one. We've got Baby Girl. There's the Greg Araki film with Olivia Wilde and Cooper Hoffman. We're going to get this one. We're good. Figure out a new genre of man or woman for an elder millennial to have sex with.
Well, very excited about this. Glad something good is happening in the world.
And yes, we do need this. We have been on record. We are Lena Dunham apologists. Maybe our most problematic trait? Who's to say?
It's up there.
So today we have something very special for you guys. We have a truly fabulous guest. She is an author, a filmmaker, a sexpert, and a fashion icon. Thank you for joining us, Liz Goldwyn.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm so grateful to be here.
We are so happy to have you, and I'm obsessed with your Substack. We have lots to talk about, but I wanted to start with the fact that I think of you as the quintessential LA woman, so I was shocked to learn that you have moved to Hawaii.
Uh-huh.
You just had a massive closet sale. You got rid of a ton of your clothes. I just wanted to hear more about this huge life decision that you've made and also what the process of editing your wardrobe was like.
Girl, I have a climate controlled storage space still in LA.
See, that was going to be my follow up question because I read that.
It's an addiction. It's a real problem. Like, I have every love letter saved from when I was like 12. I'm so sentimental and I feel the same way about clothing. Like, I have a size 9.5 foot, right? I have size 5 cowboy, like Stuart Weitzman 1970 suede embroidered cowboy boots. Like, why? I don't know, because they're so beautiful. And like, I have 13 nieces and nephews. I will only let my nieces like try them on carpeted floor and not leave. You know, it's like, I don't even know what I'm saving all this stuff for. I just find it all so precious. It's hard to edit. I'm actually going there on Monday to do another sweep, to do another sale.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, this spring. So if you missed out on the first time around, stay tuned because another one's happening. I moved to Hawaii in 2020. My company, The Sex Ed, was already a digital platform. So we were already pretty set up for COVID, and our business increased like 300% during that time because we had a podcast and we're talking about sex and all these things. Sexual wellness became such a much bigger category during that time. People were stuck at home. They were, you know, we were just speaking about OnlyFans and porn before we started. People were we were jerking off more at home. So, and they were also on journeys of self-discovery, right, during this time. And I just felt really stuck. I felt stuck in LA for a long time. I felt I was in a relationship I felt really stuck in. You know, I was CEO of a company and managing other people's mental health. And I was struggling. And I had been there once, literally once before with a boyfriend at the time, and I just felt very called from my heart to like, oh, if I can work from anywhere, I want to go there and I want to write a new book, which I ended up doing. But it was very much an intuitive decision. I think I realized that I had needed to make more decisions in my life from my heart and from my intuition instead of from my head. And, you know, not listening to what everybody else thought was the right thing for me. Like you said, you associate me with LA. But if you knew me, like, personally, or as maybe you will come to know me, I am, like, the kind of person who's happy barefoot, like, riding a bike, knowing small town gossip, really, like, low-key small town is more... LA is, like, a small town, too, for me, but...
No, I feel that. I relate to that. And I have hippie-ish barefoot tendencies as well, so I get you.
I mean, I'm wearing some really nice Alessandro Michele for Gucci shoes right now, which...
Yeah, I was going to ask you. Those were gorgeous.
But, you know, if we were... But, like, on Monday, I was barefoot. And I had no red nail polish. So I go very extreme. It's like the second I come to LA, I need to get a mani-pedi. I want to go to every single Air One. You know.
Have you tried the $19 strawberry yet?
No.
No, they have a strawberry. This broke this past weekend. They are selling a strawberry for $19.
Not a pack, just a single strawberry?
Just a single giant juicy strawberry for $19.
No, I think that's ridiculous.
I hate that. So what percentage of the wardrobe remains? Like, how much have you successfully purged?
The sale that I did that you're referring to, and they still have some pieces at Arcade Vintage at the Row, is I sold about 500 pieces. I have thousands of... So but he's coming on Monday to do another edit of the wardrobe because I was like, I'm not sure. I don't know if I want to get rid of this. You know, and for years, dealers would always contact me wanting, and sometimes I would sell a few things here and there. But the problem is, like, I just got this Prada dress I'm wearing off the Real Wheel, like, the other day.
Oh,
like,
yeah.
It's a constant, it's a constant thing. Like, you're just, oh, I'm like, no, that's it. And no more clothes, no more shoes.
I have this philosophy as well where I keep thinking there's going to be a moment, almost this sartorial moment of enlightenment where I'm like, that's it. I've purchased all of the pieces. We are also Real Real addicts. This top is from the Real Real.
Well, the second that you think you have everything that you need, there's a whole new look. Then it's like Alessandro comes in with his vision for Gucci and it changes like what you want to wear.
I actually am in the middle of a new style transformation. I've decided that my spring summer 2025 look is going to be more like classic preppy 70s.
Okay.
Because I feel like I just dress a little too eccentric. So I've been trying to tone it down. So I got like I just ordered some things from J. Crew, you know, like. A button down.
Girl, what? No, I like J. Crew, but
we love
to hear
J. Crew.
That you are a J. Crew shopper.
I love J. Crew. Oh my God, I love J. Crew. They have great cashmere. Like those little cute, like cropped cashmere. I got a cropped cashmere shell in leopard because leopard is a neutral. I got this like button down, you know, blue shirt with like red stripes, like a man's shirt. And that's part of my, like, I want to be like Lauren Hutton in the 70s.
Don't we all?
That's my like. Spring summer look.
J. Crew is also the last place where you can get a shell and matching cardigan that has completely been removed off the face of the planet.
That's the chicest Chop look wise. For
yeah,
me.
So true.
Yeah, I love a sweater set.
So I want to talk about your Substack star fucker. Great name, by the way.
Thank you.
To give our listeners context, it's kind of like Carrie Bradshaw meets Kenneth Anger. You have a lot of goss about the entertainment industry, and I wanted to talk about a few things that you've written about recently,
sure.
Including the fact that you auditioned for The Real Housewives of Beverly Hills. I was shocked. What possessed you to do this?
Well, they came to me, actually, as I just wrote a piece called Hitler and the Real Housewives, which...
we read.
So, you know, it's funny. Just before I came here, I took my sex ed team to lunch at the Grill on the Alley in Beverly Hills, which is one of my favorite L.A. power lunch spots. Shout out to Pamela, the maitre d'. And I ran into Sutton Strack, who's a real housewife. And she was like, why aren't you doing it? They came to me a few years ago and said that they wanted me to be on The Housewives at Beverly Hills. And I said, well, I'm only interested if I could talk about dismantling the patriarchy and white supremacy. And they just went really quiet and said, America's not ready for this. And then they came back again and I said the same thing and they started laughing. Oh my God, the network would love this. The reason why I did it is because to be perfectly honest, since you read the piece I wrote, I'm very much thinking about where we are in the world and in this country and propaganda and how propaganda has been used by people that maybe I don't agree with who are in positions of power in this country. And reality TV seems to be like today's ultimate propaganda. So I think I was like in my own head ideologically thinking of like, how could I spin this medium? You know, how could I make a Warholian exercise out of appearing on The Real Housewives? Could I subvert the medium and like, you know, talk about reproductive rights and that climate change and things I care about? So I kind of did the audition for the plot. I told them straight up, I don't live in LA. I'm not interested to move to LA for 3 months. I'm not your, you know, I would never let you film my private life in that way. They were like, well, even if you're a friend or you're a guest, you still have to do the audition. So I did the audition, and honestly, it was like psychological warfare. Like, you could really see how, have you seen that show, that fictionalized version of like a bachelorette show? I think it's called Unreal.
Yeah. Yes.
I felt like that. Like, I felt like I was on the other end of the producer character on that. I think it's Shiri Appleby, I think, plays the producer on it.
She does, yeah.
Yeah, she's a great actress. I really felt, like, gross after. I felt like even though I know better, I found myself feeling so easily manipulated by the questions. And I could really see that it's impossible, or at least for me, for someone who grew up in a movie business family and I'm a director too, like, I'm such a control freak. And I think it would be very hard to spin that unless you're behind the camera making that show. But I did it because I wanted to have the experience of like, well, could this be a possibility? Could I come on there and like have a different take? Probably not. Although, as I said, I just ran into Sutton and she brought it up again, like, to please come on as a friend of. So we'll see what happens.
Perhaps you can come in next season and do a sex ed seminar for all the women.
That was my pitch, is that I wanted to come on and do like kind of like a sex dinner party. And of course, they would probably make me look really stupid, but I mean, we'll see.
So if you can believe it, looking at her, Chelsea is a huge Taylor Swift fan.
Okay.
You wrote a great series about your childhood home. By the way, our goal is to have our listeners, who we call fuckettes, subscribe to your amazing Substack. So
to get all of the goss.
Yeah.
Yes. So apologies making you reveal stuff that is hidden behind a paywall.
That's,
but we
all
have
right.
we have a greater goal. Obviously, you have this unique connection to Taylor Swift through the purchase of your childhood home, which I'm sure is quite bizarre. I guess there's no good way to ask this, but are you a fan of her music by chance?
I've never really, I mean, obviously I know the songs that you've heard like when you're out and about, but to be honest, it's just I'm like a hardcore hip hop head is, you know, more my speed, you know, so it's not necessarily what I would turn on, but I'm obviously like familiar. I have a lot of respect for her as an artist and a business person, and also I really respect that she's gotten my family house, which my grandparents built and my dad grew up in and I grew up in, designated a historical property and like has restored it. And that, you know, means a lot to me.
Are you aware of the fact that she has written songs about her houses before? Like, I feel like there could be one on the horizon about your childhood home.
Well, there's a Wikipedia page devoted to, like, the Goldwyn Swift estate, which I only discovered when I was writing that piece. And because honestly, for a while, like, my grief over his death was too fresh and I really couldn't, you know, handle it. And she wanted to talk a lot about it too when we met, and I wasn't ready for that. But I read the Wikipedia page and it says that she's recorded some of the albums in that house. Like, she's built a recording studio, and so maybe she already has written about the house.
It must be bizarre to be kind of tethered to a big pop star in this sort of very unique way.
You know, you might see it as bizarre, but I feel like because I've grown up in all of this, like, I could probably tell you other stories that, like, I would find more bizarre, you know, than that. Yeah, I don't know. I guess so. I guess because I'm not that well-versed in the lore.
And that's totally fine. I wouldn't think that you would be. You seem far too cool for that.
No, I mean, I do love, like, I mean, God, I was, like, obsessed with Madonna, right? She's, like...
Of course. Well, if
like the Madonna of, well, she's more she's more conservative, right?
Yeah, I wouldn't say she's a lot like Madonna.
Well, just in the level of global superstardom and...
Yeah, of course. I feel like she's almost even more famous than Madonna now, which is crazy. I feel like she's on that, like, Michael Jackson level, which is nuts.
Yeah.
Off mic, Chelsea can give you a whole primer on Taylor Swift if you would like.
You do not need it. You do not need it. But if you do like rap music, the Reputation album might have something for you. The Bad Blood remix with Kendrick Lamar.
Right. I do know that I'm a big Kendrick fan. I do know that she did that. I do know she did a song with him.
We're still shocked that Kendrick did that, but it did happen.
I also try to be really like respectful because, again, privacy... obviously not at all to like the level that she deals with, but like from the second I was born, you know, our house was on the maps of Hollywood stars' homes. When we were little, my dad would be like, don't pick up packages left outside. He would, you know, people would be writing him from death row. I've had stalkers since I was a young woman, which was really scary. And then it became even more so once I started professionally writing and talking about sex. So I can't even imagine what it's like, you know, to be a female celebrity on that level. I think also that's what's always scared me about fame and interested me about other people from the outside looking at and being like, I want to be famous, because I was always brought up to be so cognizant of like fame equals people digging through your trash. Fame equals men wanting to kill you. You know, this is the real. This is real. Real life that people don't think about. You know, you do hear about someone, you know, someone got arrested trying to break into her house or whatever. But, you know, it's very scary being on the inside of that, you know, and like not being able to have normalcy in your life. Like, I can't even imagine that.
And I'm so sorry for what you've experienced. That's terrifying. And I can't imagine what Taylor goes through. I mean, we know she's gone through a lot. And I do want to clarify for the listeners that your piece was much more about your family and grief and the significance of this home to you than about Taylor specifically, but is someone that has always followed you and her. I found it to be fascinating.
Thank you. Yeah, and it was interesting to write about it, like when I, because it's just like a six or seven part series, and I think in the last one I'm talking about us meeting on Oscar night like a year after my dad died, and just going back and actually researching a bit of her career when I was writing it, I realized like I was going through my grief, but she was going through that court case at the time where she was suing the guy for harassment for $1. And that was, I was also writing about Hollywood at that time, and it was like Me Too time's up. So it was really interesting to think about my path and what I was dealing with and observing at the same time as thinking about what she was navigating as a woman in the entertainment industry. So it gave me like a whole new, you know, perspective on her. And also the way that like my grandparents would entertain or my parents would entertain back in the day, and like the kind of parties she's, I'm sure, having at that house, you know, privately.
For sure. I hope she's having fabulous ragers with lots of crystal sherry glasses and whatnot.
I'm sure she is.
So you've mentioned in your DMs to us that you have Sarah Jessica Parker stories. Will you spill them now that we have you on the podcast?
Yes.
Yes. So I met her through my brother, Tony Goldwyn, who's an actor and director. And you might have to Google it. I feel like they worked together. I think they worked together. I don't know how they were first friends, but we met when I was going to art school in New York when I was like 17.
You went to SVA.
I went to SVA, and I worked at Sotheby's auction house. I helped start the fashion department, which was like really fun and interesting. And I met her. We went out one night. That's the first time I met her. We went out one night with my brother. And it was really funny because my brother is like, I have never had a friend like gay or straight that has not had a crush on my brother since he's my half brother. He's 17 years older. So from the time I was like a little kid, it was annoying because everyone would be like, oh my God, your brother's so hot. And I'm like, hello, we have the same genes. Why aren't your brother so nice? Like, nobody ever was saying that about me. I'm like, what? Am I an ugly bitch? No, I'm just kidding. But anyways, I digress. So we go out with my brother, you know, gets this attention, but he literally, you would think he's like a naive hick from like Nowheresville. He's just so... he is genuinely like a nice guy, doesn't know who anyone is, doesn't know anything about pop culture at all. Like one time we were somewhere and we were sitting next to Mary J. Blige, who was fanning out over him. He had no idea who she was. I was like, oh my God, can I please please get a photo? So we were out with Sarah Jessica sometime in the 90s in New York, and we went to the Bowery Bar, and Tyra, you remember Tyra Banks? Like, you know, that was, yeah, obviously Tyra Banks was like in her hate. I don't think she had, I think she was like still modeling. It wasn't like America's Next Top Model days yet. Maybe, I don't remember, but she wanted to meet him. And me and Sarah Jessica were freaking out because we were both really into fashion. And Tony was like, oh my God, you have to meet her. She's so cool. We want to meet her. And he was just like, oh, like a little dumb, didn't know who she was and know who any models were. So we kind of bonded over that. And then she wanted to buy her first Hermes bag. And
okay, this is piping hot for our audience.
Is it? I mean, Sarah Jessica, I know you know I'm not spilling any personal tea. This is like a long time ago.
No, no, we've just, because we started as a Sex and the City Instagram, we've charted the irony of Samantha wanting a Birkin in that infamous episode with Lucy Liu, and then to hide Sarah Jessica's pregnancy the next season, suddenly Carrie has a gigantic Birkin because that was kind of the only the biggest bag that could cover her baby bump. So
I think she wanted a Kelly bag. This must have been, I was working for Sotheby's, it was probably like 1999 maybe, and she wanted a Kelly bag, and she wanted a vintage Kelly bag, and so she came to me at Sotheby's because she wanted help to buy one. And I was always like the conduit for like Hollywood, you know, back then. Also Demi too, who has an amazing collection. Also I knew through my brother because they starred in Ghost together. So, you know, a lot of these like great, amazing women I met through my big brother, which was great. So that was cool. Fun that I got to help her buy her first Kelly bag. And she was so excited. What year did Sex and the City start?
98.
So it was really, yeah. So this was like 98 or 99. So this was like right at the beginning. And to be honest, I didn't watch the show until like much later. And I don't know, like, you guys know better. Was it an instant success? Was it, like, huge right at the beginning?
It definitely made a mark. I think it got, it was huge by the end. I think it definitely made a splash in the beginning. And the Vogue covers and the press and all of that, I think, came around the middle of the show. Like, yeah. The third season.
Yeah, I was going to say third or fourth season. I think it had reached the masses.
Yeah.
So while we have you here, can we talk about some recent fashion news?
Sure.
Okay, first, I think we should get into Sabato De Sorno has left Gucci after 2 years. His successor is yet to be named. What do we think about this? Obviously, you're repping Alessandro Michele Gucci. You've interviewed him.
And Gucci sponsored your podcast.
They did, and I'm carrying a Valentino bag that Alessandro sent me because he's now at Valentino. I love Alessandro, and I also love Tom Ford, who was at Gucci back in the day. To me, honestly, it's like non-news, him leaving. I feel like it's designers are treated like chess pieces, and it's just gotten worse and worse and worse. It was so, you know, great back in the day when you had like Galliano, Dior, doing Dior Couture and Gaultier, and it was so exciting, and people had a chance to grow at a brand. But 2 years is not enough time. You know, it's all about the bottom line. I don't think that's enough time to like foster a vision. I'm an Alessandro supporter, so I don't know who's going to go in at Gucci, but it's got to be someone that's going to be commercial.
Yeah, but it didn't work for them last time. I think this ultimately shows that, like, there are downsides to greed, right? Like, they
think
there are commercial downsides. There are certainly creative downsides. They wanted exponential growth with Gucci. They got that from Alessandro, but you can't sustain that indefinitely.
No, I think we're entering into an interesting time in like the luxury fashion market. And, you know, that's why someone like, you know, Mary Kate and Ashley Olsen with The Row have such an interesting business, because they're kind of, you know, consistent. They don't operate always by the traditional calendar. I think it's really hard, because the bottom line for companies like Kering and LVMH, which are the two main groups which own a lot of the, you know, brands, everything from Balenciaga to Stella McCartney to McQueen to Yves Saint Laurent on down, it's about selling handbags and perfume. You know, it's not really about what you see on the runway, because I don't know about you, but like, I would never spend that much money on a dress. I think it's crazy. Like, I've always been into vintage. I'll buy like a Prada shoe over like buying a Prada dress. Even though I would love to buy, you know, a brand new Prada dress, I could never justify the kind of money that that costs. I just think it's like,
of course, that's what the real is.
Yeah,
for.
Let's put it into let's put it into real estate. Let's put it into art. Let's put it into things. But also, you know, working at Sotheby's gave me an idea of like what clothing has resale value and what doesn't. And so that's another thing when it comes to like hiring a designer who'll be at a house, like who's going to make the collections that are going to have retain their value, like down the line, like an Hermes Kelly bag does.
This is true. I mean, we talk about this on the podcast as well. I often make this point that they are looking for designers who can make the next it bag because that's really where the profit center is.
But Alessandro sort of made it sneakers, it bags, it belts, like almost sort of every single accessories category. Like there was just instantly like a huge boom in sales. I mean, still today walking around LA, you see so much of that stuff on
the
street.
I wear a lot of, I mean, I love his stuff.
I've made this point on the podcast before that I feel like what's going on in the fashion industry is very similar to what's going on in the film industry, is everyone is so risk averse. I feel like a lot of these conglomerates, whether it is in the entertainment sphere or the fashion sphere, are like, well, we're going to let the audience tell us what we should be making. And it's like, no, you need an eccentric tastemaker. Like, people don't know what they want. That's why you need someone with an extreme point of view to tell people what they want.
It's true.
Yeah.
Okay, I also need to hear your thoughts about the new partnership between Nike and Skims. They have started a new brand called What Else? Nike Skims. A kind of insane partnership for both parties. What do we all think? Are you a Kardashian person at all, Liz?
What
I'm guessing
you,
what
no. Do you think?
Well, I worked with Kendall.
Oh, cool.
I directed
That's right.
this love meditation that, like, back in, it was a long time ago. It might have been 2015. 2014,
I think so,
2015.
Yeah.
And she was great, really professional. I have like such a fascination with Kylie. She, when I was doing book tour for Sporting Guide, my second book, I literally spent like 10 minutes of my AOL build talking about her Snapchats and like how she has a yogurt machine at home, and which is weird because the book is set in 1890s Los Angeles in the world of vice and prostitution. So it has like nothing to do. I don't know. I just have this like fascination with like Stormy's first birthday party and how she got that Chanel bag. I wrote a column for Poosh, like a sex advice column for Courtney's company Poosh, and she and my brother, another brother, younger brother, went to school together. So that said, I own some Skims underwear. I bought like one thing from the Dolce collab they did. I bought like a little leopard like baby doll because I do like that. I mean, I don't want to like publicly wear Dolce anymore and support them, but like who doesn't love some like 90s Dolce references?
Leopard print.
Of course,
yeah. And a leopard print.
No judgment.
But I think I'm going to sell it because I've never worn it. You know, so I feel the same way about the Nike Skims collab. It's like sort of like, for me, it's like, who cares? It's just going to end up in a landfill.
I don't know. To me, it makes a lot of sense because it like, it kind of benefits both parties, right? Because Skims is not going to have the sort of technological innovation and the production capabilities of Nike when it comes to like leggings and sneakers and stuff like that. So it makes sense for
their nipple bra and butt padding notwithstanding.
Yeah, but also Skims has done some stuff that is quite innovative, like the nipple stuff, like some of the shapewear.
I'm wearing a nude Skims bra right now.
Yeah,
like, see, you know, they do make...
I'm wearing Skims right now, too.
Yeah.
How about you, Lauren?
I think I'm wearing a Skims bra as well. Yeah, it's a good product.
It's a good product.
It is.
And I would, like, not buy Victoria's Secret, for example. And I spend a lot of money on lingerie. Like, I love really good matching lingerie. But the thing is, all that, like, beautiful colors and lace, it doesn't look right under certain outfits because you can see through it. Nothing pissed me off so much as when I'm watching movies and like, okay, what's the movie 50 Shades of Grey? Okay, this pissed me off. So I hate the continuity in the costume department in movies when they like just get something that's so obviously wrong with fashion. Like in one scene, in the first 50 Shades of Grey, she's trying on this like long line Mary Widow lace up corset, right? And then the next scene, she's supposed to have put on this like floor length silk satin bias cut dress over it. And I'm like, ugh! She would not be wearing a corset under a slit bias cut dress because you would see every line on it. It drives me crazy. So Kim Kardashian, to her credit, understands this, you know, that like sometimes you need a really good seamless product.
I love that this is your criticism of 50 Shades of Grey. Oh,
my brother Tony made this movie with, it was like Diane Lane's comeback, and actually Viggo Mortensen and Liev Schreiber years ago. It's called A Walk on the Moon.
Yeah, I've seen that movie.
And he was like, what did you think? And I was like, well, you know, in the love scene between Diane and Viggo where he's like unbuttoning her blouse in the car, she's wearing this like blue synthetic lace button-up shirt, and that kind of lace wasn't invented in the year in which this, he was like, only you are gonna notice that. I'm like, but it's so obvious. This lace is synthetic.
Chelsea would also appreciate that. You are someone who asked for your money back after seeing Atomic Blonde because you felt that the costumes and the production design were not period accurate to the 80s.
Well, you have to give the Arclight a reason when you're asking for a ticket refund. So I figured that was as good as any. R.I.P. Arclight.
Wait, oh, Arclight's gone?
Yes.
Did I not know that?
Oh, I'm sorry to be the one to break the bad news. Yes.
Oh, that's so sad.
It's gone.
So, wrapping things up, the Met Gala is coming up, and as someone who has gone when it was still, as you said, in your Substack, gatekept, thoughts on how the Met Gala has changed, thoughts on this year's theme?
I mean, I think this year will be very interesting because who knows where we will be at in May, just what with, like, DEI initiatives and the theme of this year's gala. I think has the potential for being either really charged in a political sense or people being really afraid of being canceled. I think it's long overdue to highlight Black style. God, the stories I could tell on that subject in terms of the fashion business, but that's for another podcast maybe.
That's for your highest tier paywall.
Yeah, I do have a lot of stories of Condé Nast and internalized racism, but especially when it comes to fashion. So I think it's really interesting that we're only coming around to this subject and highlighting Black style now, especially since, for example, like Jackie O, who's heralded as a beacon of American style, Jacqueline Lowe was her dress designer, who was a Black designer.
Ann Lowe, sorry.
Yeah, I think it will be, I'll be curious to see, because also some of the hosts too have very strong political opinions too. And so did Anna. So I'll be very curious about how all of that plays out against the lens of how do we use fashion or art to reflect the times we're in? And is it just going to go into a space of like apathy and commercialism and, you know, advertising for brands? Or are we going to use this moment? Are people going to use this moment as a way to, you know, express themselves through clothing that will reach so many people? Because you can reach so many people through fashion.
See, when you said, I don't know where we'll be in May, my head instantly went to like Trump firing Andrew Bolton and making himself the head of the Costume Institute.
I mean, I always am careful because I never know what anyone's political leanings are. But yeah, I think that's a real thing. You know, I think also the same thing, like the word around town, we're recording this during Oscar week. You know, it's just a very strange time right now in the arts and in arts that have traditionally been more outspoken and liberal, especially in his first term in office. It was in fashion, too. And we're in a really different place now. People are afraid. They're really afraid to speak up. They're afraid of their bottom line. And it concerns me. It concerns me. And I think that, like, arts, fashion, music, filmmaking, theater, comedy are like the last bastion of resistance and revolution. And like, so I personally hope that we see some of that, even though now it feels like it's much more risky for people as artists, as public personalities to do so because they'll be targeted. But what are we going to do? Are we just going to let this become a fascist country? I don't know.
God, I hope not.
I hope not, too.
Trying to think of an optimistic note
yeah,
to
let's
go
end
out
on a lighter note. Let's end on a lighter note.
Liz, thank you so much for being here today. Truly, we're so honored to have you on the pod.
I'm so grateful to be here. Thank you. I didn't mean to bring it down. I think that joy and fashion and lightness and happiness is something that we have to really cling to, lean into, you know, always. Because as Janis Joplin said, if you buy it today, you don't wear it tomorrow. You got to get it while you can.
Guys, if you enjoyed this conversation, you can get so much more of Liz on her Substack, Starfucker. We are each individually members, and it's the best purchase of the year, frankly, for myself.
Oh, thank you. I really appreciate that.
Thank you, Liz. Hopefully you'll come back. Hopefully, you know, we can talk about the Met Gala, perhaps.
Hopefully Liz will come back. We will definitely be back next week to talk about the Oscars. See you next week.
All right. Bye, guys.
Bye.